Tell Them I Said No by Martin Herbert. Introduction. They make me feel dirty and inadequate. Those websites. The ones featuring couples and groups. Tides of bodies. Old and young. You've probably looked at the photographs too. Taken at openings and dinners and parties. Artists with arms slung eagerly around dealers and collectors, grinning for the flash, available, biddable, ugh. But still I look. In the past I even supplied content, and when I look, I sometimes think of Stanley, who's never there. Of Stanley, Albert, Katie, David, Laurie, and others, past and present, habitués of the opposite of there. The photographs I possess of Stanley Brown make me feel dirty as well. The artist who since the early 1970s has snubbed almost every form of publicity tried to destroy all trace of them. But people, especially when they've been commanded otherwise, will talk and show, and others will listen and look and take smartphone snaps of those photos they can't keep. Faced with a muteness as artful in its chicanery, as paradoxically gifting as Brown's turns out to be, one might twist between appreciating the nimbus of silence around a practice, and teased and goaded, commissioning scratch translations of sneakily recorded phone interviews with him, found on YouTube. The following essays twist. Distancing is a leaky boat, increasingly so. Nevertheless, such self-detaching on the part of artists goes somewhere. As performed today, it pushes against the current in an epoch of celebrity worship and its related feedback loop, increasingly universal visibility and access. A big part of the artist's role now in a massively professionalized art world is showing up to self-market, being present, on all channels, ideally. See how, aside from all the photo opportunities, far from digital native figures take to social media, or splash themselves, when possible, across magazines, which grander galleries now produce themselves, or collaborate with fashion designers, all gates open. For younger artists, meanwhile, the visible crown of youth can seem like a necessary attribute. The paradigmatic figure might be the art student too, busy with exhibitions and networking prospects to graduate, flanked by flippers, a 5-year career ahead of them. In such a context of hectic short-termism and multiple types of oversharing, some kind of voluntary retreat, some respect for the Joycean triumvirate of silence, exile, and cunning might constitute a vanguard, if a difficult and apparently suicidal one to countenance today, since it seemingly requires earning the right to leave, and an increasingly rare forbearance on the part of one's gallerist. But for a range of artists, particularly over the last half century, since the ascendance of pop and the idea of the artist as celebrity, prototyped by Dali, and more quietly Gauguin, perfected by Warhol and updated by Koons, Hearst, and so on, positioning oneself somewhere on the axis of absenting has served, variously, as a reservoir of energy and a permission for idiosyncrasy, and, trite as it sounds, inner journeying. It has constituted, among other things, a hard scrabble route toward integrity, where the tail doesn't wag the dog. A cipher of self-actualization, a symbolic resistance to gendered or racial subjection, a species of performance, and a seductive projection screen predicated on the theory that the more someone runs away, the more we'll run after them. None of this, meanwhile, has transpired in a steady-state art world. Rather, the urge to pull back where felt, echoes changing conditions over decades, from the swing towards dematerialization and its intersection with critique, to Arndt's transmogrification into a backcloth for the power plays of the prosperous. Marcel Duchamp, who claimed to have traded art for chess, but toiled in secret for 2 decades on his Etant Donnés, 1946 to 1966, and who told Calvin Tompkins in 1964 that he thought, quote, "The great man of tomorrow in the way of art cannot be seen, should not be seen, and should go underground," end quote, is the public face of this standoffish school. So patently that there's no essay-length footnote here to his art's endlessly foaming exegesis. If a handful of other figures have followed the self-described breather in being at once inside and outside the art system, perhaps the most remarkable is David Hammons, who treats the art world as a high-stakes game of strategy, to be played from a highly critical distance. Hammons doesn't come to us. We come to him, effectively at his bidding. Another of his progenitors, Yves Klein, wrote a judo manual in art and in martial arts. Its author pursued judo's precept of, quote, "the minimum effort for the maximum effectiveness." And one might see, in all the aforementioned tactician's practice, a technique of using the art world's weight against it. That's the case for Stanley Brown, for Lutz Bacher, and for many a figure such as Maurizio Cattelan, who at the time of writing may have retired or may have not. Some artists withdraw temporarily out of necessity. In 2007, I asked Robert Gober what he planned to do next. He was just about to mount a major mid-career retrospective, the kind of sketch for a tombstone that can paralyze an artist, and he said he intended to let his assistants go and really not do much for the next 5 years, except retrench and reconsider. This struck me as fully admirable, though somewhat unlikely. It turned out to be more or less true. Sometimes there's no choice. That appears to have been the case for Agnes Martin. And sometimes, when there's no choice, depending on the reason, absconding manifests as total tools-down non-participation, exemplified here by Charlotte Posanenska, Katie Noland, and Laurie Parsons. This is the far end of the continuum of remove this book sketches out. Full withdrawal registers as exasperated reaction to the intolerability of the art world, to the limits of political potential, to gender bias, profiteering, the presence of repellent personalities and neon egos. The structural sexism of this sphere may, as the examples named above already suggest, underwrite one broad cleaving along gender lines among these practices, that men are more likely to step back to a safe distance and women to quit outright. Precisely why this might be, beyond the wearying perpetuation of disparity in prices, representation in museums, and so on, is something I've tried to address on a case-by-case basis. Research also suggests, though, that the official narratives aren't always fully accurate, that while history implies certain artists walked out and slammed the door, in reality they opened it again, or sought to, or never quite closed it. We sustain the approved storyline sometimes out of unawareness, sometimes for sentimental reasons. In the latter cases, voluntarily or not, the refusenik operates as, to use the epithet Christine Mering once applied to Posanenska, our bad conscience. We project our own misgivings about the art world upon such a figure, upraise their rep as a gutsy ideal. Some writings about Noland read like love letters. Wholly quitting or making oneself inaccessible can also be a deliberate conceptual act. Witness Turing Say's work. Following a series of endurance performances and a long period in which he said he would make art but not show it, in the end his work boiled down to a single terse statement, "I kept myself alive." The Taiwanese artist officially quit art in 2000. He has kept his word. Or witness, as essayed in this book, Christopher D'Arcangelo's practice, in which withdrawal takes its darkest and most irreversible turn, even when not framed as such, though a partial disaffiliating can tempt one to register it as a para artwork in its own right. The degree to which that is truly the case is something wrestled with, where appropriate, in the essays that follow, and creates its own momentum. The sway of such gestures is testified to by exploits like the Samizdat exhibitions, in which Hammond's and Noland's works were recreated from images found on the internet and in exhibition catalogues, organised by New York curatorial outfit Triple Candy in 2006. Full-on quitters like Noland, dropout artists, as some have termed them, are naturally objects of particular fascination, not to say romanticism and vicariousness. Even if their acts are the reactive results of extreme vexation, they illuminate a road not travelled by others who might wish they dared. They also constitute an example of what's possible, articulated in the negative when you're not terrified by the attention economy. There's a shadow history here too, that of those artists who drift out of the art world all the time, flouting the pious assumption that one must always remain in it because, well, actually, why exactly? The more unassuming leavers' names are lost to history. A decade ago, I met a spectrally calm young man who made limpid paintings of consumer objects, items of worldly contemplation, underwritten by their maker's meditation practice. He told me his name was a pseudonym, though it was only years later that I realised he'd taken it from that of a Zen monk recluse, and by that time, after a career of 5 years tops, he had completely vanished, gone from the galleries, the internet, mostly everything. A Pyrrhic victory, perhaps, but also a reminder that the art world isn't everything, and an art career doesn't have to last a lifetime. We can probably all name artists who don't quit but should. Concerning those who leave, what one longs for, or what this writer, who sees too many exhibitions that are blatantly products of the studio treadmill, which circularly pay for the assistance and the fair booth acreage, longs for, is some tactical thinking. No artist needs to undertake a half dozen solo shows per year, plus fairs, plus a continual side salad of group shows. Artists who do this, given the unassailable fact that most of them are not modern-day Picassos, will in most cases burn out and deliver diminishing returns in the meantime. One wishes, however vainly, one writes, at least in part, to accrue useful examples of such, for artists to make statements when necessary and to be silent when not. We have no shortage of art or of galleries, and, as Mark Twain once said, no word was ever as effective as a rightly timed pause. The art business runs on personalities, at least in part, and personalities can be powerfully elliptical too, not least because, surprise, in an era of artistic production lines determined by the frequency of fairs, is a rare property in art. Among younger artists, one might look to someone like Trisha Donnelly, not removed from the art world per se, but refusing interviews and presenting exhibitions increasingly without elucidatory supports. As someone who has exemplarily figured out the weight and value of silence and self-containment. A figure like Bacca, who prefigures her, meanwhile, has for many years operated less like most artists than like, say, Scott Walker, whose musical career over the last three decades has been a string of well-timed pauses, punctuated by out-of-the-blue statements, crafted on his own terms, and whose visual iconography these days reduces to a baseball cap hiding his eyes. I bought an issue of Pop, partly because I wanted to read the Grimes interview, and partly because I was amused by a strapline on the cover, trailing an artist's Instagram artworks. Heart, Richard Prince, Heart, so jazzed about the new era. Then I went back to thinking about Albert York. A rare retrospective of his paintings had just gone up at Matthew Marks, New York, at the same time as Richard Prince's contentious social media-derived works were hanging at Gagosian Gallery. A couple of painter friends who stay in a lot had alerted me to York a few years before. His story has been rehearsed a few times, most famously by Tompkins in a 1995 New Yorker profile. It's a tale of steady, determined succession that echoes Balzac's short story of artistic frustration. The Unknown Masterpiece, 1831, moving away from New York, sending his paintings to his gallerist wrapped in brown paper, refusing retrospectives, impossible standards leaving York feeling, so he told Tompkins, that almost all he'd done was bad, going round and round in an increasingly small place, but seeing it with an intensity that's almost violent. The paintings he made between the mid-1960s and early 80s convey that. Still lifes and paintings of cows and landscapes and the occasional surreal Native American that stage a transfiguring of reality. Trees appear sentient amid gilded moonlight. Cut flowers come across as gigantic architectonic things, which language, or at least mine, doesn't get very close to. York was, by all accounts, chronically shy. But he turned that around, his inwardness blooming outward. He stayed for a while, earned the right to leave in search of quietude and focus, and then, freed of the city, did something quietly monumental for the ages. Choose to choose, choose to go, sang Lou Reed in 1967, a couple of years after York packed up for Southampton, leaving a Manhattan newly filled with pop art. York is dead now, but you don't have to be dead to be gone. And just because you're gone doesn't mean you're not here. Quite the opposite sometimes. Ask Stanley Brown if you see him and say hi from me. On and off the grid. I was standing among the islands, 12 unearthly canvases in manifold grades of white and fairest blue that Agnes Martin painted in 1979. But I wasn't thinking about them. A couple of rooms earlier in Tate Modern, I'd read the text Martin wrote concerning her 1973 sequence of screen prints on a clear day. Quote, "These prints express innocence of mind. If you can go with them and hold your mind as empty and tranquil as they are and recognize your feelings at the same time, you will realise your full response to this work." End quote. An invite with an afterglow. Yet the islands, quiet brimming things after the eye retunes, their sangfroid surprisingly welcome, the horizontal lines dividing and pinning their paleness massy with auspicious imperfections, also reminded me of something. I felt it thickly in the hailing light. In the early attainment stage of sitting Zen, Zazen, thought evaporates through focus on the breath, and the ensuing clarity is mobilized in various ways towards the remote goal of enlightenment. Without an empty mind, there are things you can't feel, can't reach. In Martin's case, what's cached in her art for the disposed, quieted viewer, who has substituted febrile analysis with receiving, can be as simple and as complicated as happiness. Now, this meditative connection is perilous, subjective, and precisely the kind of interpretive link Martin issued injunctions against. But it's also as natural as breathing. Though Martin wasn't doctrinaire in anything except delivering her own opinions, she studied Zen Buddhism and Taoism. Plus, to quote Jacqueline Bass's summary, quote, Old Testament, Calvinism, expressions of visionary Christianity, Platonism, Transcendentalism, and Vedanta, end quote. D.T. Suzuki lectured in New York in the 50s, and it's been posited that Martin went to hear him. Her close friend, Ad Reinhardt, was beguiled by Far Eastern philosophical traditions. And an undated letter to her long-standing gallerist, Arne Glimcher, in which she apostrophizes the Buddha's flower sermon, clarifies she worked on cones. Glimcher has also written that Martin meditated daily. This eastward lean was not, of course, wholly unusual in the keener corners of post-war America. But Glimcher adds, as Martin would have done, that there is nothing mystical about her work, and equally vouchsafed in that the islands and elsewhere is a hard-headed pragmatism of the plains that nevertheless veers towards the transcendent, avoiding unto serenity in readiness for inspiration. Martin, who at least outwardly didn't give a damn what the world thought, and who famously christened a 1997 sextet of paintings with My Back to the World, spoke recurrently about inspiration and the mental decor necessary to receive it, empty, untroubled. In 1972, 4 years after she relocated to the New Mexico desert, where she would live for another 42 years, she said, quote, I used to look in my mind for the unwritten page. If my mind was empty enough, I could see it. End quote. In Mary Lance's serene documentary, Agnes Martin, With My Back to the World, completed in 2003, a year before the artist's death, at age 92, Martin says that, quote, if your mind is full of garbage, if an inspiration came, you wouldn't recognize it anyway. So you have to practice quiet, empty mind. End quote. The consequence of her assiduous self-questing, no matter what traditions she drew on, is well known. Decades of luminous, humming condensations of emotion in reductive pictorial form, works as democratically buoying, assuming you give them your time, as Bach or Mozart. Martin preferred Beethoven, though he unsettled her. She played Bach every day to remain balanced. To get there herself, though, and one of the many contradictions in her life and character, is that she was essentially railroaded towards contentment. Martin had to perform a double withdrawal. Circumstances led her to turn her back on people, transferring from city to desert, and for the most part, living wholly alone. And she had to shift from the collective sphere of facts, illusory to her, founded on naught, into the annulled bays of her own head, so that emptiness might be returned, coherent and convivial to others. If you're alone, you focus in on everything. You're just affected by everything. The sky and wind and air and nature, all of nature. And you're responding 100%. The best moments of my life were when I was alone. The most enlightening and therefore the happiest. End quote. Martin says in Lance's documentary. However much she'd explored solitude before, one might imagine it began involuntarily during her childhood, when her mother would use silence as punishment. In 1967, her self-isolation began in earnest. In that year, at the age of 55, she spent the money from a grant on a pickup truck and caravan and lit out from New York, the city she had arrived in 15 years before, at the urging of gallerist Betty Parsons, after living and working in New Mexico since the mid-1940s, travelling the United States for 18 months. By this time, she had made the major breakthrough in her art, the discovery of the grid. But we can also discern a medley of reasons why she might abandon the city, wrapping her troubles in distance. In 1962, Martin had been hospitalised in Bellevue for schizophrenia, receiving electroshock treatment before her friends could stop it, after being discovered wandering catatonic in Manhattan. Shock had not cured her. She heard voices, dropped into trances, and clung to omens, and particularly for such a person, certain other events perhaps served as beckoning off-ramps. Martin had recently lost to developers her paradisiacal to a cognoscente of austerity studio in a heatless 100-foot-long sailmaker's loft on Coenties Slip, Lower Manhattan, where for years she had painted and lived a disciplined life alongside Ellsworth Kelly, Robert Indiana, and James Rosenquist, with Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg for neighbours. The same day she was told the building would be torn down, she received a grant, the means to buy a vehicle and leave. Reinhardt had just died of a heart attack at the age of 53. Martin's relationship with Greek artist Chryssa, whom Glimcher remembers as, quote, much more violently psychotic than Agnes, end quote, had apparently just ended. After this, she would have no others. In the documentary, she says, again echoing Buddhist thought, that she had lived many lives before, in which she was married and had children, and this time had asked to live alone. She was, furthermore, apparently experiencing a self-lacerating relationship to pride, resulting from the amplified attention her art was now receiving. When her new home in the desert was taken from her a few years later, she said she deserved it, that she'd been too prideful again. Relatedly, she had been embarrassed by the minimalist contingent of artists exhibiting alongside, whom she would later claim as a self-declared abstract expressionist, an artist of feelings, to have been a mistake. We don't know the rankings of these dynamics. Martin, as Nancy Prinsenthal recounts in her 2015 biography of the artist, said various things. In 1981, she said, quote, I came to a place of recognition of confusion that had to be solved. I waited patiently for something like permission to leave, end quote. Which she goes on to say came after a show in Los Angeles. In 1983, she said, quote, I left New York in 1967 because every day I suddenly felt I wanted to die, and it was connected with painting. It took me several years to find out that the cause was an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, end quote. In 1996, she said, that it was connected with the loss of her loft. At another point, Prinsenthal recounts, Martin said she recognised she had already made some masterful paintings, and so she could leave. The story kept changing, or all the aspects mattered to changing degrees. She went, and in 1968, a vision of an adobe hut fetched her back to New Mexico, where, renting a patch of land on a faraway mesa in Sandoval County, her voices apparently told her not to buy, just as they later said she couldn't have a garden. She erected an adobe and log house, and in 1972, a studio, and managed without television, radio, newspapers, telephone, or electricity. She collected rainwater to drink. When she began making art again, it was because she was approached with a proposal to make a set of prints, and because her reputation apparently swelling further in her absence, a curator at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia invited her to have a retrospective. The print series, made in Germany, turned out to be the 30-part On a Clear Day, a deeply satisfying mathematical group of grids, among her last, closing of the old road, commencement of the new. Martin's remembrance of how she originally discovered the grid doesn't quite fit the evidence. She spoke of a grid rising up in her mind as she ruminated on innocence, the upshot being the tree from 1964. Though she had in fact been painting grids since around 1960. One change in the interim, what might mark the later grids as different, new, was their diffusion to the canvas edge, delivering objecthood to the painting. The grid Martin described in 1967 was a lightning, a demonumentalizing, quote, "When I cover the square surface with rectangles, it lightens the weight of the square, destroys its power," end quote. This airborne quality is key. In the eye, the grid jiggles loose and hovers, Peter Sheldahl has written persuasively. Edge and shape, figure and ground, and matter and atmosphere are reversible, bringing about, for me, a sense of oscillation in the optic nerve. That reversibility might also be associated with interdependence and mutual support. The oscillation delivering a kind of blissfulness of balance. Certainly, degrees of delight are the terms in which Martin couched her work. She spoke, in 1981, of shifting, albeit within the diapason of suddenly experienced and fugitive emotions, from joy to happiness, in the spell between the last works made in New York and On a Clear Day. The year after producing these prints, inspired anew by them, Martin broke a nearly 8-year spell of not painting. When she did, offering the completed paintings to Glimcher's gallery Pace, who gladly took them, she unbuckled the grid, abbreviating it to the horizontal stripe, a format again open to interpretation. Not that interpretation is the point, experiences. Martin now also began using colours more readily, if parsimoniously. Pastel pinks and blues and yellows, watery oxidized reds and ochres. One might, many have, hallucinated in them New Mexico landscapes, peachy glare as native light, adobe ciphered in dusty reds, and be led astray. A local world glimmers in the work, but when indulged, it weighs the paintings down, limits them. Martin spoke about her feel for the flat landscape, the impression of expanding over the plain, but also of her paintings' horizontals in no way representing that. Rather, she suggested, the viewer moves inward over the line. This gravitational drag is the signature course of Martin's art. The mind, not receiving quick distraction, slows. The eye, pasturing appreciatively. Tiny shifts, starting to count. Barely perceptible colour voicings. Eccentricities of pencil and paint application. The whole commencing to hum. To pull. If there is a gentle blaze to the work, then it isn't keyed to something in the world. It feels grander, yet more internalized than that, and as such strongly associable with the abstract values Martin would talk about, happiness or subsets of happiness like amity. Facing the canvas, her language becomes plausible, even if we wondered how much we were primed. One might also think at some point, it's inevitable if you know the biography of what's bridled by those horizontal lines and convivial colours on those consistently square canvases. Throughout her life, though she took medication after a certain point, Martin continued to endure schizophrenic episodes, evidently deciding to face these alone. That aforementioned abortive relationship, whose ending can't be fully factored out of her self-isolation, and her sexuality per se constitute a black box that those close to Martin refuse to speculate on. One might think too of her upbringing with an extremely disciplinarian Presbyterian mother, which Martin claimed to value while also telling writers she had suffered emotional abuse. Leonard Cohen once remarked concerning his own time in a Zen monastery that nobody goes to such a place who isn't already broken. It would be easy to look at the circumstances of Martin's life and call her damaged in several ways, survey her consummate achievement, and footnote Edmund Wilson's 1941 essay collection on childhood psychological distress and artistry, The Wound and the Bow. Martin wasn't a transcendent individual. She was patched together as we all are. She was an ascetic who liked fast cars. Her art drew on the landscape but didn't. She officially discovered the grid 4 years after she really did, and so on. But the art, which in any case she didn't even attempt when suffering visitations, waiting them out, shimmers on the other side of all of this. A beaming white matrix of fine vertical rectangles like morning is cool, Euclidean precision, commuted by light and dimensional definitude, made approachable, humanized by Martin's faintly quavering fist. Later work, such as Happy Holiday, 1999, banded alternations of tempered apricot and light blue, gives one a flash of brickwork and empyrean in midday whiteout, before dispensing with such associations and asserting zest distilled, a portable sweet spot. At such moments, Martin makes you forget all about her and about everything else, but you have to wait for that to happen, become like a pond without ripples. Her embarkation becomes yours, but thinking won't help you go there. Dependence on the intellect, Martin wrote in a notebook, quote, is so thoroughly taught that some people think they would die if they stopped thinking, end quote. It is this insistence on being egalitarian and outsmarting the brain smart that makes Martin at once hugely accessible and, in the post-war settlement of art as a custom of intellection, a wordless challenge. In 2004, the artist who lived on rainwater and drove a white BMW, who painted abstract works all her life and then closed with a petite sketch of a pot plant, went into the light, leaving her accumulated light behind. The following spring, under a full moon in the garden of the Harwood Museum of Art in Taos, clandestinely against New Mexico law, Despite her own work being in their collection, her ashes were placed in a Japanese bowl lined with gold leaf, then scattered in dug-out ground among the roots of an apricot tree. Out in the world, Facebook had recently launched, and YouTube was about to go live. The world plunging into accelerated connection and distraction and superficies, turning its back ever more emphatically upon Martin's self-designed model of soulful quiescence. In my best moments, she wrote, quote, I think life has passed me by, and I am content, end quote. Glimcher sang favourite songs to her in her last days, and sometimes she sang along. She liked blue skies, he would later write. Martin's final painting comprises two wide bands of white, dividing a sallow squall of grey. Rain will fall, but tranquility is always there, behind the clouds. And there's no rain. And there are no clouds.